Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas. On Tuesday, December 23rd, we say Merry Christmas to all of you. We hope that you have a wonderful holiday with your family and eat a lot of food. Isn't that what the holidays are about? Speaking of food, we had a great show last night with Sonia Martinez and Marta Verdes Darby. It was a show about Cuban food and the Christmas season. And it's in the archives, so check it out if you enjoy Cuban food. You will enjoy the show. Plus, these two ladies are absolutely wonderful guests. I mean, they keep you laughing. They keep you going for the whole evening. So check that one out. Last night, Cuban food and Feliz Navidad was the name of the show. Today, we're going to stay with the topic of Cuba, and we'll be chatting with our good friend Victor Trey. Victor has just published the third book of a series of books that he has put together. Wonderful writer, wonderful topic. This one is called On Freedom's Shore. And, of course, for those of you who are familiar with the previous two books, it's a story of a Cuban family, starting in the 1950s and now all the way up to the 60s, arriving in the United States and, you know, going through that that period that so many of our parents went through, which were, you know, as I like to refer to it, el periodo del exilio. El exilio is what our parents used to call it. When you're new in a country, you're grateful to be in the country, but nevertheless, there are difficulties and challenges that our parents or some of our grandparents had to meet. So we're going to get into that tonight with Victor. Just a quick word about our friends at Audible.com. If you enjoy listening to books, and I know many of you do, well, we're going to recommend that you go down to the show information and click on Audible.com. It'll take you to their website. They have a tremendous website of just a great inventory of audiobooks. You check them out. And if there's something that you like, if you pick a book, you're going to make my day. How's that for a challenge? Pick a book, and you're going to make my day. We're going to take a little break. We've got a little Christmas music here, and we will be right back with Victor. What a great selection of Christmas music. Our friend Mario Ajero, he's actually a music teacher at a university here in the Texas, one of the University of Texas campuses, and he's put together a CD of Christmas songs, interpretations like that, and piano, solo piano. And they're just fantastic. They're quick. I mean, they're great for the radio because they're quick in about a minute or so. But they're just absolutely beautiful as background music. You kind of get the feeling that there's someone playing the piano in your home. So Mario Ajero, A-J-E-R-O. We'll put a link on the show information. But it's a great, great Christmas, absolutely great Christmas CD. Let's say hello to our good friend Victor Trey. How are you, Victor?
Hello, Silvio. Nice to talk to you again. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Yes, absolutely wonderful to have you. You've become quite a prolific writer, my friend. I mean, you know, I like to think that writing one book in a lifetime is production, but you're like, you know, a book machine. I mean, I'm very proud of you. You're a great friend. I'm very. I mean, just a wonderful. I guess once you get into it, you just cannot finish it, huh?
No, well, you know what, and I have to confess, thank you for the compliment, but the Unbroken Circle has been under construction for many, many, many years. Hold on just a second.
Sure.
And, I mean, really since the early 2000s, and it's only lately that I've been releasing it. And so, yeah, I mean, it seems like I wrote, you know, each book in a year or 6 months, but in fact they've been under construction for many years.
Okay,
so.
Well, maybe it's just the way that, maybe it's because of the way I got to know you. It seems like I got to know you just as they came out. So I keep
right.
thinking to myself, man, this guy is something else.
This guy, you know, writes fast.
Yeah,
right.
You write fast, and you do, but they're great books. And we'll get into the books in a minute. I thought the timing, of course, of our conversation tonight is very interesting because of the stuff that has been in the news about Cuba, and we like to get into that in just a minute. But let's do this, Victor. First, let's hear about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then after that, what I like to do is tie the three books together for some of the listeners who may not mm-hmm. be familiar with the previous two books. So first about yourself, and then the first two books and how they lead to the third book.
Sure. Well, as you know, Sylvia, I was born in Miami, and I was raised in Miami, Florida. My family had left Cuba about 6 years before I was born, 1960, and then the rest of them in 1961. So I was raised in Miami, and I kind of had this, you know, this is always in the atmosphere in Miami. This is always in the air in Miami. And when I was in college, I sort of took an interest in it. And then eventually when I was in graduate school, though I started out as a Europeanist, and to a certain degree, I still am, I think, at least in interest and teaching and all of that. But I was very drawn to the Cuba topic. And then I wrote my master's thesis on a Cuban exile topic. And then continued on with my PhD, also in a topic dealing with Cuba. And then I just started writing about it. And, you know, many years later, I still am. And, of course, my first few books were academic works. The first one was about Operation Pedro Pan, which at that point there hadn't been a book written about it. And then I wrote the first one, and then that was followed by a book about the Bay of Pigs invasion. And then, you know, one quick, there was this one, it's kind of complicated to explain, but it was a book of photographs of the Cuban Revolution. And I wrote, you know, most of the running narrative with it. And then, you know, all these years I had been working on this Unbroken Circle. And I'd always wanted to write fiction, even before I started graduate school. And then finally, you know, I was able to do it.
Right.
Almost as soon as I finished up the Bay of Pigs book, I started doing it.
You know what? What is fascinating about your book? It is a fiction story. It's obviously a fiction story of a family, their own family. But what I find it, and I mentioned this to you on a note that I sent you. What I find about your books is that it's like you're reading. At least I read it almost as if I was reading my family story. That what
sure.
you're talking
yeah.
about, what you're detailing, and you do such a great job of research and you know, in character development and all of that, but it's almost like the people that you're reading about, Victor, are people that you become very attached to, and I guess it's because we have that Cuban background. You become very attached to them, and you can see yourself, you can see your uncle, you can see your grandfather, you can see your father. I can see
sure.
myself, although in all honesty, I was a little bit younger than at that time, but still, I mean, it's a familiar story to all of us, and that's why I think the book has been so well received, Victor.
Sure, and of course, where I grew up, you know, everybody had these stories.
Sure.
I didn't always dare ask people who had been through a great deal, you know, people who had been in the Bay of Pigs invasion or families that had suffered, but you always knew about them, and of course, during the course of my research, I did interview a lot of them. Sometimes I was interviewing people I'd known since I was a little kid, but had never spoken to them about these things. And of course, besides them, there was, you know, my own family and all my friends' families and relatives and everyone else that I could draw on. And of course, all the people who I interviewed for the Pedro Pan book and for the Bay of Pigs book and for everything else. And of course, after the Pedro Pan book came out and after the Bay of Pigs book came out, the number of stories I heard from people that I didn't interview was, you know, maybe more than the number of people I actually interviewed for the book, you know, at different book
right.
signings, book events, people contacting me, et cetera. And they're all familiar stories to you, to me. If you grew up in Miami, if you grew up in, you know, Union City, New Jersey or something. But I don't think that they were very familiar to the average American. And I did notice when I left Miami, and as you know, I've been out of Miami for more than 25 years now. Whenever I would tell one of these stories, it you know, either people were amazed or they were amazed, but there might be some little part of them that didn't believe you or thought you were exaggerating, because the tales, the stories are so incredible to the average person that I noticed very early that, you know, this is something that really needs to be said. This is something that needs to be put out there so that other people would know this. And, of course, in academic writing, you reach a more limited audience, but in fiction, you reach a very broad audience. And, of course, everything I've written has been in English, aiming not just for a Cuban-American audience, but, of course, for a more general audience as well.
Right.
And I have, you know, had some books sold in Great Britain and in other places, too, not a lot. But at least I know someone over there is reading it, but they are incredible stories. I mean, you know, if I told you someone's story, you'd nod your head and go, oh, yeah, I know a lot of people like that.
That's right.
But if you tell people who have no experience with this, they're just, I mean, even when I tell my family story, and my family didn't suffer nearly as much as a lot of other ones did, with, you know, executions and separations and all of that. And I'd see how they react to, you know, my family story, and I'm like, my goodness, you know, they should hear some of the stories I grew up around, you know,
right.
some of the people. So, you know, I decided to, you know, take this to a more, you know, non-Cuban public in English and, you know, using that style to try to reach them.
And what you have done, if, you know, even if you don't reach any Americans, I know you have, but I'm just saying, even if you don't, you have contributed something of very significant to the Cuban American library, so that 30, 40, 50 years from now, somebody wants to learn about what that period was like. Well, you pick up one of your books and you get the historical context as well as the family story that was very typical of a lot of families
of that
time. Now, let's connect the three books and just kind of briefly explain 1, 2, 3 and how we get to 3. And I guess 3 is the last one. Is 3 the last one, or is there going to be a 4th?
Yes, yeah, it is a definite conclusion to the series,
okay.
Although I do have a book 4 outlined, but I don't know if I'm ever going to write it or not.
Okay.
But it does exist in outline.
So
there's a definite conclusion.
Right, so this is like, if they make a movie out of your books, this is like Godfather 3, right? This is
exactly Godfather 3, Lord of the Rings, take your pick.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So why don't we do this? Let's kind of, if you could just briefly do number 1 and number 2 and then into number 3, so that the listener has a chance to see how it all fits together, because this is one of the great things you've done. You fit this thing together beautifully. So
Thank you. Explain it to us. Well, I mean, sure. I mean, you know, I tried to create a family that would have universal appeal, you know, middle class, the father's a teacher. He does come from an aristocratic pedigree, but aristocrats who had lost their money 2 generations earlier. It's also, you know, people who are, you know, aristocratic make more interesting reading as well. I mean, middle class people, for some reason, you don't see, you know, them depicted a lot in literature. But again, I tried to make it the way a lot of people were, you know, and many of the Cuban exiles were. These were mostly middle-class people, professionals, who were not involved in politics at all, who were not pro-Batista people. You know, if anything, you know, most of them were anti-Batista and wanted a democratic form of government in Cuba. But they kept to themselves, you know, quiet, you know, unobtrusive middle-class people who all of a sudden wake up one day and they find themselves in the middle of this Cold War drama, right, where all of a sudden Cuba becomes their home, becomes their city, becomes ground zero in the Cold War. And we're so used to now looking at Cuba and knowing that that's happened, but if you put yourself on the other side of it, I think most of these Cubans were just amazed that of all places in the world, their home, Cuba, would be playing such a significant role in the Cold War, and that their lives would be so deeply affected by everything that was happening, their jobs, their careers, their homes, their family, their way of life, religious worship, every aspect of their lives all of a sudden was turned upside down. And in the least likely of places. I mean, you would have thought this would have happened somewhere else in the world, but it didn't. And so this family, you know, sort of is drawn in to the whole struggle against Castro. Like most Cubans, they didn't support Batista, but they certainly didn't support Castro, at least not after the first couple of months. I mean, of course, at first there was, you know, they were happy about it, like anyone else. But as soon as they saw the communist colors, of course, they turned. And given who they were Catholics. They were in the Catholic schools, etc. They were in that set. And of course, this family, at least the father and two of his cousins, are kind of drawn into the underground. And his cousins were two university students, which, as you know, the university students were very active in Cuba. Had always been, and of course, were the center of the anti-Castro cause. And they get drawn into the underground here in book one, which is called The Struggle Begins. By the way, if you look for the books on Amazon, it's best to look for them by individual titles. So book one is called The Struggle Begins. And at the end of book one, there's all sorts of things going on besides the political drama. But there's the first separation where that father with two children has to leave the country because he's nearly got caught for being in the underground, and so do the two cousins. And they end up in the United States, the older cousin in Miami and his two younger cousins in New York City. And, of course, they join the brigade in book two, and they go off to the Bay of Pigs invasion. And, of course, everything I did and every corner that I wrote of, every event, I tried to make it very historically accurate because I knew the day was going to come when I'd be standing there at a book signing, and the room would be filled with people of that generation, and who, as Cubans, don't hesitate to correct you when you were wrong. So everything I did, every street corner I wrote of, every store there was, the baseball stadium, the wild fans, the individual guy, the guy with the bagpipes at the baseball stadium, right. I tried to make it all accurate, even a red light district. You know, I looked up a map of Havana, and I knew where it was. I found it. I gave the names of the streets, et cetera. And then in book two, I mean, I interviewed many, many, many Bay of Pigs veterans, and I know the story fairly well. And so I tried to do everything as perfectly as I could and basically put these characters into it, the transportation to the camps, the training, when and how they were told that they were going to the invasion, the transportation to the launching point, the trip, everything. The only parts that I took a little bit of license in book two, I explain in the introduction. You know, mostly the pilot's briefings, mostly because I wanted the reader to understand what was going on. And so and there were briefings, whether what I said in the briefings or what I had characters say in the briefings was actually said, I'm not sure, but it was the same end result. But I explained that, you know, in a very detailed fashion. And then, of course, the parts on the invasion, I think, are very accurate, or as accurate as could possibly be, of who landed where they went. And basically, I just put my characters into it. I put an extra squad in the 2nd Battalion, and I put my three characters in it. So I invented an extra squad. But they lived through everything they lived through. On my air attacks, I have one character who's a pilot, and in his air attacks, I throw in an extra airplane just to have my character in it. I didn't want to say that there were the same number of airplanes as there really were, because then I'm putting someone in with real people, and these people have families and they have widows and all of that.
Right.
And so I didn't want to make up what happened to their their loved ones, and so I just threw in an extra plane there, all the way to the end of the invasion. And of course, what happens to the main character's family after the invasion collapses, and what happens to the three cousins during the invasion, which I won't give away. But basically, at the end, the main character's two children, because of the same pressures that so many Cuban families went through when communism was being consolidated, the closing of schools, the pressuring the children to join the mass organizations, etc., these children leave on Operation Pedro Pan. And I also created a character who I think is a universal character, and he ends up being more of a symbol than a character. And this was a former employee of the family's bank, because the family did own a small bank. And, of course, you know, he becomes that guy that many families had, whether it was someone they knew or someone who worked for them, who, as soon as they were in power, just stuck the knife right into these families. And, of course, he later comes to represent, you know, even though it's a real character, you know, he comes to represent the pressure and the power of the Cuban government over individuals' lives. And he's the one who's present when the mother finally makes that decision. You know, the children have to leave. And, of course, the mother can't leave because the father's in prison. And, of course, it ends there, book two. And then book three is mostly about the children and their experience as unaccompanied minors in the United States, or refugees in the United States. And of course, we know there was that whole exodus of children between 6 and 18 called Operation Pedro Pan, which I wrote a nonfiction book about, like I told you earlier. And, of course, I tried to make that as exact as I could, too, although there I took a little bit of license also. And I had more freedom as well, because there were so many Pedro Pan children. 7,000 of them ended up in the Cuban children's program that provided care for them. But once they were sent away, anything could have happened to the children. Anything. They could have gone to a foster home. They could have gone to a boarding school. They could have gone a lot of different places. So that's exactly what happened to mine. Anything happened to them, and so I was able to invent this whole situation of what happened to them. And that's what's going on in book three.
That's right. So at book three, they're also coming to the United States and dealing with. What I said in the introduction, el exilio, which I always, from my own parents' experience, they were obviously very grateful to be here and very grateful to the United States for the opportunity and the freedom that was brought. But that doesn't take anything away from the fact that it was difficult to a brand new country. I mean, I sometimes, you know, it still amazes me. The incredible job that all of our parents and grandparents did coming to the United States. Just absolutely amazing job.
Oh, absolutely. And so many people ended up out of Miami as well, like your family did.
Right.
Which I think probably made it, maybe in the short term, it made it easier because there were more jobs elsewhere. Salaries were higher elsewhere. But I think in the long run, I think that those families who ended up going to places like Wisconsin and things
right.
like that, may have had it a little bit more difficult because they weren't around their culture the way, say, the ones that, you know, who were in Miami were, and or in New Jersey or wherever there was a dense concentration. And so when you think about it, they did have advantages because, I mean, this was a country that was 90 miles from the United States, not on the other side of the world. It was a country that most middle-class Cubans were very familiar with, had traveled to. But in spite of all that, you're right, it was very difficult for a lot of people, especially, you know, how their lives declined and their status declined. And you know, all of a sudden, who they are in the world completely changes. You may have had somebody who was a very successful architect in Cuba or
right.
a very successful mining engineer or whatever, and these are examples that I'm thinking of, you know, of actual people either who I know or
sure.
I've heard about, who all of a sudden are parking cars in Miami Beach or working in a factory, in upstate New York or somewhere, all of a sudden it's difficult. And especially if someone was in their 40s, their 50s, their 60s, they're set in their ways, they worked all their lives, they saved money, they did the right thing, and all of a sudden, you know, they're living in an overcrowded apartment
right.
Trying to figure out how they're going to feed their children.
That's right. And I think something else you mentioned, I guess at the beginning when we were getting started with the conversation, that all of this, I can tell you from my parents, the last thing, if you had said to my parents, in 1959, that they were going to spend the rest of their lives in the United States, they would have
right.
thought you're joking.
As
they would
exiles.
Have said, "Oh, come on, what do you, yeah, exactly." Right now, not as people who you're right, as exiles, that people had to leave their country to go to the United States. They would have thought you were joking because
they would have thought you were joking. And I think that as exiles, is really important because Cuba has a long history of
right.
exiles. But who are the exiles? The exiles were usually people who were somehow politically involved. You know, people who were somehow rebels or were attached to the wrong government that got overthrown or something. But, you know, I even have a scene in book two where my main character is on a beach going between his job working as a towel boy at a hotel on the beach. And he's going back to his little dinghy apartment and he's just thinking to himself, how could I be an exile? I mean, exile
right.
is the sort of thing for, like, you know, French radicals and, you know, Russian revolutionaries,
right.
Not quiet middle-class people,
right.
but all of a sudden you have these hundreds of thousands by the early 1960s of, for the most part, quiet middle-class people who are all of a sudden exiles. I mean, you know,
that's
people
right.
like that aren't supposed to be exiles.
Yeah, people whose
exiles
lives
are for radicals.
Just,
you know?
Exactly, mm-hmm. people whose lives were just turned upside down from one day
mm-hmm.
to the other. You know, people who woke up in January of 1959 in Cuba, you know, thinking,
right.
well, okay, we'll go through another little crisis like we've had before. And then 5 years later, they're waking up in Wisconsin. And,
right,
and,
exactly.
And
they've
got
to go out and shovel snow before they go to work.
Exactly. And they must have been saying to themselves, how did this happen? I mean, how
I
think that, and this is something that I believe that generation had to deal with, and I think they dealt mm-hmm. with it. You know, when you look back at it now and you see the success of our parents, grandparents, incredibly successful generation of people, because I think they were not ready for this, but I think they had the backbone, they had the temperament, and probably the faith. I'm going to probably put a lot of emphasis on faith, because
mm-hmm.
for them to come here. So now, let me ask you a question. What if you I'm going to invent an episode in your last book and in your third book. Imagine
mm-hmm.
that the characters of your book are sitting around and they're talking about the future, and one says to the other that the president of the United States is going to reestablish relations with Cuba, and I'm kind of tying this into what's happening now.
Yeah.
What?
Sure.
I mean, I think I know what my parents would have said. I'm assuming the characters in your book would have said the same thing, because a lot of those people feel very betrayed by what President Obama, yeah, has done. And I know our friend Carlos Aida, you know, the author of
mm-hmm.
Waiting for Snow in Havana.
Waiting for Snow
in Havana,
sure.
He wrote a great letter that appeared in the Washington Post, making
yes,
that
I read
point.
It.
He says, "I feel betrayed by my government."
Right.
So what's
exactly.
your reaction to these news?
Well,
events?
You know what? I don't have to imagine it, because there was an article about the Bay of Pigs veterans and their reaction to it. Of course, the Bay of Pigs aren't monolithic. You're always going to have those, you know, who might think differently. But I think that the person who spoke for the majority. And I'm quoting a Bay of Pigs veteran right here. Quote, "When the Bay of Pigs was abandoned, we were sad. And now we feel abandoned again, betrayed by the president." And I think that kind of sums it up. I mean, you know what? A lot of those early fighters, you know, it was one thing after another. It was one thing after another. I mean, first, the United States helps Castro get into power, but the United States was under the same impression that most Cubans were, that this was going to lead to democracy. And then, you know, they what most people don't realize, and especially when you hear comments of non-Cubans in South Florida, they don't realize that the Cubans in exile, okay, weren't fighting Fidel Castro, right? They weren't. It wasn't Cuban against Cuban. If it was Cuban against Cuban, then the outcome probably would have been differently. The Cubans in exile were fighting Castro and the Soviet Union, right? Castro, without the Soviet
right.
Union, was nothing. He was
right.
very, very, very little. But with the Soviet backing, all of a sudden that changed the whole dynamic. This was the middle of the Cold War. The pro-communist people had the Soviet Union behind them. The anti-communist people, wherever you were in the world, had the United States behind them.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a reach for Cuban exiles to assume that the United States had their backs. And what's more, they didn't just assume that. They were told that. They were recruited by the United States. They were organized by the United States, along with Cuban leadership, but the United States was in the middle of it. They were sent to Central America, obviously by Americans, especially since the pilots were contract pilots who were from somewhere in Eastern Europe. They had American trainers at the training camp. Okay, they had American weapons, they had American planes, they had American everything. They were transported. They were told, we're going to be right behind you. Don't worry, these people on the ground. And then somebody at the White House pulled the rug out from under them, pulled it out from under them. And then after that, you know, there was always still the promise, and different agencies were always involved. But without, you know, more backing, the United States, or rather the Cuban exiles, wouldn't have been able to do anything. What's a group like Alpha 66 or something going to do against the Soviet Union?
Oh, sure.
Right?
Exactly.
Nothing. For the exiles to succeed, they needed the United States behind them. And so I think that there's always been that sense that betrayal was very strong. And there's this one scene that I have in book two, which actually happened. You know, here are these guys. It's the third day at the beach. The perimeter has closed down to almost nothing. They're shooting their last bullets at Hidong. Right, the front had pulled back, and an American, and then of course they're already feeling betrayed by the United States. They're already starting to seethe and wonder what happened. But some had already figured out that they'd been abandoned. And then a U.S. destroyer, and this really happened, it pulls right up to the shore. Right, I mean, right there, close enough to destroy all of Castro's force on that same road. And some people say, finally, they're here. And then that destroyer just picked up, turned around, and left. I mean, that just kind of just sums it up. And some of the people on the beach started shooting on, you know, people on our side. Of course, the ship was 2 miles away. They wouldn't have ever reached it, right? But there was always that sense. There was always that sense. And, of course, now what most people don't get, it's not about economics. It's not about anything. It's about morality. It's about legitimizing this government, about telling them we recognize you, and therefore everything you've done is okay.
Right.
Everything
it's like
you've
giving
done
them
is legitimized.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. We've given them the victory, Victor, that they
mm-hmm.
have been seeking. I mean, by basically agreeing to their terms, we have legitimized them, as you say. We've given the Castro government a victory that they probably never thought they were going to get.
Probably not.
I mean, I'm sitting around.
Sylvia, not only that, we're throwing them a lifeline at this moment. When the Soviet Union fell in the early 90s is when Chavez, not long after that, got into power in Venezuela. For years after that, with rising oil prices, Cuba basically had a deal with Venezuela. We'll help you build your police state. We'll run your army. We'll run your intelligence services. We'll create a guard, a Praetorian guard around your leader in exchange for cut-rate oil. And that kept Cuba afloat for a very long time. And all of a sudden, this year, very recently, Venezuela is imploding under Maduro now because oil prices are plunging. And now, you know, Cuba's about to lose that. And right at the moment they're going to lose it, now our president goes out and throws him a lifeline. I don't understand it. And this, 2 weeks after, the United States enacted sanctions on Venezuela. Venezuela's run by Cuba. Cuba's responsible or playing a big role in the human rights violations in Venezuela. We impose sanctions on them, but we don't impose them on Cuba, who's running Venezuela. We're lifting them. I don't understand.
And then, I don't get it either, Victor. And then to make it so almost obscene, you have Raul Castro in Cuba basically sticking his finger in Obama's eye, saying, I mean, almost humiliating Obama on the world stage.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, by saying, we're not going to change. You mean those fugitives from that's your problem. We granted those fugitives asylum, so we're not going to send them back. And, you know, all these investors, well, that's your problem. We're not going to compensate anybody. And then I think the most humiliating of all was forcing the United States to trade, and that's what it was, a trade, for Alan Gross for these spies. I mean, that is so humiliating. So I'm sitting there saying, what was Obama thinking during this whole process? Now they're saying
that's absurd on so many levels. If you just look at this speech, I mean, if you're the average American, you don't know the difference. Okay, Alan Gross was a Jewish American who was there helping the Jewish community establish internet. That's all he was doing. That was his great crime. The guys that we had in prison here, one of them was in prison because he played a role in the death of a U.S. citizen and the murder of a U.S. citizen. How is there an equivalency? But here's the greatest irony of all, okay? Here's the greatest irony of all is that, you know, here's the president discussing internet access in Cuba, as if the United States, you know, what they're doing is going to give Cubans internet access. Now, you know, and I know it's not true, because Cuba does business with everybody in the world, including Mexico, the European Union, and Carlos Slim, remember, the world's richest man, lives in Mexico, and he's got one of the world's biggest telecom companies, not to mention ones in Germany and other places that they do business with in Japan. That hasn't resulted in Cubans having internet service. But here's the irony, right? You know, in part, we're doing this to get Cubans internet, when the guy that we're getting in return for these prisoners was a guy who was in Cuba trying to help set up the internet.
That's
he just served all these years in prison for doing so.
That's right.
I mean,
and the
it's amazing, like you said.
Yeah, and then you have the situation where the Washington Post, by the way, had two great editorials about.
They sure
about, and the second one where they were complaining that we had thrown so many of the dissidents under the bus, because if you're a dissident in Cuba, if you're the opposition in Cuba, the only thing you really had going for you, the only hope you had, was the embargo, because the embargo, I mean, other countries could do business with Cuba, but Cuba's world was shrinking a great deal, in large part because they cannot pay their debts. And so, I mean, here we have just thrown all these dissidents under the bus in the name of, I mean, some of the explanations from President Obama were so silly that, well, you know, this has not worked. Well, I think it has worked. I mean, the embargo has actually worked quite well. So I guess, you know, the anger.
Not only that,
Cuban
that's right. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the anger in the Cuban American community is very high at the moment. And I think, you know, when I was looking at your book, your last book, and I was saying to myself, you know, after I read the book, I was saying to myself, many of the people who are outspoken about what's happened between President Obama and Raul Castro are the people that you were writing, you know, the people who had come here, like our parents and so on, who
Absolutely.
Could not have imagined that this day would come. It's like the Bay of Pigs all over again.
That's right. And there's a sense of abandonment. And, you know, and like you said, it's a moral question. But keep one thing in mind. Okay, when the United States opened relations with the Soviet Union in the 1930s, there was a certain group pushing for it. Just like here, there's been the same basic group pushing for it with Cuba for years, and that's big business. Okay, the quasi hippie guy from the 60s with the sandals, you know, who went to cut sugar cane in Cuba and loves the Cuban health system, that guy doesn't have any influence in Washington. Okay, he may hold signs, you know, whatever, and have, you know, clever little slogans and whatnot, but he doesn't have any influence. But big business does, and big business has been dying to get into Cuba for many, many, many years. What they're going to do there, I don't know. I don't know, because Cuba can't pay its bills.
Right.
You know, maybe they'll get Cuba loan guarantees from the U.S. government or something, and when they don't pay them, the U.S. taxpayer will end up paying, and I'm sure all of your listeners would love that.
That's right. Would love to have another bailout, but one thing they may do, a lot of these, I'm not going to say names, but some of the hotel chains and some of the large businesses could go into Cuba and maybe buy some of these Spanish hotels or Mexican hotels and basically bail out the Mexicans and the Spanish and some of these deals, because the reality is that at the moment Cuba really doesn't have in the short run the ability to build that much more, because they don't have the hotels. I mean, they don't have the telephone lines, the infrastructure. I mean, when a tourist goes to Cuba, he wants to have wireless, and Cuba doesn't have that. And
you can have that just at the hotel.
That's right.
Wi-Fi there at the hotel.
Yeah, you could.
Keep in mind that Cubans aren't allowed to stay in those hotels. There is tourism apartheid, but also remember how the hotels there work. The Cuban government owns a majority of it. The foreign company that runs it owns a minority of it. But who in Cuba owns it? Is it independent investors? No. It's the top military people, the top state security people.
Right.
Someone wrote an article the other day where they said, imagine if Marriott and Hilton and Radisson were subsidiaries of the CIA. That's what it is in Cuba. And that's who you're going to be doing business with. When you go, when these hotels go, or these manufacturers go, or these whoever go, who are they going to do business with when they're there? They're going to do business with criminals. They're going to do business, and which is going to involve property that was stolen from somebody.
Right.
And keep in mind that those employees that they're going to hire in Cuba are going to have 90% of their salary taken by the Cuban government. I think they should make a requirement if we're going to do this. And if and just because there's normalization doesn't mean the embargo is going to be lifted. But if
the embargo
is lifted, say any U.S. corporation doing business in Cuba, right, you have to guarantee that any employer you pay actually takes this percentage of their pay home, 70%, 80%, 60%. And if you're paying them and the Cuban state is taking 90% of it, there'll be penalties to pay in the United States.
That's right. And they ought to, that's right. They should make it so that if X company goes to Cuba and opens the hotel, they're the ones paying the Cuban workers directly. They're not doing business with some one of these government agencies.
Because
otherwise, you're exactly right. I mean, we know what's going on. It's a big racket.
It's a racket.
It's a horrible racket, and the Cuban people are getting screwed by all of this. Well, let's conclude. It's been a great conversation with you, but
thank you, sir.
I want to congratulate you on your book, the third volume. And I know you also put together a little YouTube video that I saw that is really cool.
Yes.
And you can also get all three books together, right? If you're thinking of you still have time for Christmas, you can tell your family.
It's on Kindle, so you can have it within 5 minutes if you want.
Oh, there you go.
But,
so you get all three of them. Yeah, there you
go. Exactly. But the best way to search, I think would be if you just put in the title of book one, because if you put in the Unbroken Circle series, you have to actually go through a little bit on Amazon. But if you just put in The Struggle Begins, right, and you see the book with the Cuban flag on it, that's book one. And,
well,
and
the way
and
that
course,
the way I've done it, Victor, is that I just put your name.
Okay,
when you go to Amazon,
most people don't know how to spell it.
That's true.
But
it's
T as in Tom, R-I-A-Y.
That's right.
Right.
So what I do
Tom,
is I put
too many vowels.
Yeah, that's it. I put books, and then I spell your name, or I write your name, and then everything comes up because you have a page, which also helps. But again, congratulations on the success of the book, and thank you so much for joining me tonight. And also, I appreciate very much your input on what's happening in Cuba. We just couldn't avoid it because of the situation going on in Cuba. But I want to say again, as I told you the very first time, that I think your story is our story. You have written a book. You've written a book that tells my story, your story, and that's of lots of other people. And that's why, when I read your book and others have told me the same thing, sometimes there are tears in your eyes. Sometimes, there's anger because you know what these people were going through. But it is a very human book, and I hope that there's something more coming in the future because, I don't want to tell you to write another book, but I hope you're thinking about some other book about the Cuban migration because you really do such a great job that I almost feel like you owe us another one, Victor.
Well, I'm actually now working on a book on the Mario Boatlift, which should be
out
in a couple
good.
Of years. But this one's nonfiction.
Okay, all right. Well, that may be a little harder to write nonfiction, but I just want to tell you that I love the book, and I think of you as a great friend, and I wish you the very best, and Merry Christmas to you and your family, and keep writing, my friend, because this is something you do very well, and I know.
Thank you, Silver.
I've seen some of the notes going up in Facebook, people saying that it was a wonderful read, and it was, and Merry Christmas to you, and keep writing. That's
my
New Year's resolution, is I want you to keep writing.
Thank you. Thank you. So I appreciate it, and thank you for having me on. I always have an excellent time on the show.
Well, thank you so much. Victor Trey, author, and we would encourage you to go to Amazon. And, the way I did it, which I thought was very easy, I just put his name, Victor, T-R-I-A-Y. You put that on there, and it'll take you to the page, and you'll get all the books. And as I say, this is a book that puts a tear in your eye. Sometimes it makes you angry because you know the suffering that some of these people are going through, the racket of the Cuban communists. So sometimes you get angry when you're reading this book. Other times it puts a tear in your eye because it reminds you of your family, of your parents, your uncles, and what they went through. I think I sent the note to Victor one time saying that this is our story. I mean, I feel like I'm reading my family story, and I'm sure all of you feel exactly the same way. Well, thank you so much for listening tonight. We're going to leave you with a little Christmas music. Good night, everybody. This is Silvio in Dallas.